There's an update in the research on cumulative traumatic encephalopathy. So on this episode, we're going to talk about it. And happy Friday to you. My name is Connor Collins. I'm a registered massage therapist and sports injury therapist. And welcome to the Concast, a podcast where we discuss all things health, wellness, and injuries in an attempt to better understand the human body. This is episode 115. And for today's episode, I want to yet again discuss cumulative traumatic encephalopathy, a really long-winded word for a disease of the brain. And this is often known in the media as CTE, or the acronym CTE, which some of you may know or have heard that acronym and be a little bit more familiar with it. And so I did an episode on CTE, episode 72, which I'll link in the show notes. And one of the conclusions of that episode that I had made or that I'd stated was that there was currently no evidence to link RHIs or repetitive head impacts to CTE, mainly because at that time there really wasn't any research that was published on the strong link or causation between the two. Now, while there was speculation and some thought that they may be, there wasn't really any research or papers that were supporting this speculation. And that was until recently. There was a study that just came out in July. So just last month, on CTE and the potential link or causation between CTE and repetitive head impacts. So the study is called Applying the Bradford Hill Criteria for Causation to Repetitive Head Impacts in Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy. And this was published by Nowinski in Frontiers of Neurology. And so what I want to do is take you through this paper, take you through the way that they were attempting to prove causation, and maybe give and lend my thoughts on what this might mean for sports in general and individuals that play contact sports. So before we get into the paper, what is CTE? So CTE is a neurodegenerative disease. So it's a disease of the brain that is progressive. And so this is a disease that has been described in the literature as early as the 1920s in boxers. And I go much more into detail into kind of the background behind CTE in episode 72. But if you had ever heard of the term punch drunk in boxing, that's what it was commonly referred to it as back in the 1920s. And then more recently, in the last 20 years or so, the research around repetitive head impacts and the long-term consequences of them has increased substantially. When we saw this make its way into mainstream media with the movie Concussion with Will Smith, talking about the impacts on Dr. Bennett Omalu's life when he first brought this to the NFL. So it's become quite a popular topic since then. The interesting thing about CTE is, based on our current medical diagnostic equipment, we have no ability to diagnose someone with CTE when they're living. And most of these diagnoses come after the fact, when someone has passed away and donated their brain to science, and we've been able to autopsy the brain and then come to that conclusion. Now, there have been some advancements in maybe a subset of symptoms that might lead someone down the line of a potential for CTE diagnosis, or struggling with the impact of a history of playing sports with repetitive hits to the head. This can range from dementia to addiction, risky behaviors, degradation of mental health. And so the thing about this symptom or myriad of symptoms or kaleidoscope of symptoms is it's difficult because these symptoms are also part of other mental health challenges or disease processes. But one of the things that seems to be consistent in this a collection of people is that they have a longer standing history of either playing sports with repetitive head impacts or in environments with repetitive head impacts. So we might see this in veterans, for example. What we're going to do is talk about this paper, talk about the criteria that they use to try and predict causation and why that's important, and then what does that really mean for the general population and public. So what is the Bradford Hill criteria? It was first proposed in 1965 by Austin Bradford Hill. And what it is it's 9 viewpoints which evaluate epidemiological evidence, and that long-winded word means the development or incidence of disease, in an attempt to determine causation. So Bradford Hill is used particularly in cases when we are outlining or looking at potential environmental exposures and causation. Now, in this circumstance, environmental doesn't mean like the weather, although it could be the weather, but things within the environment that we are exposed to that might then cause a injury or disease down the line. So what are some examples of environmental exposure? Well, being in the presence where you're receiving repetitive hits to the head, that could be an environmental exposure. This could be as a result of sport. Again, it could be as a result of being in the army. What are some other examples of environmental exposure? So exposure to maybe secondhand smoke on a regular basis and its potential causation or linked cause to lung cancer. The first question that we have to ask ourselves is, why is causation important? And particularly when it comes to CTE, why is causation important? Well, in recent years, the discussion between repetitive hits to the head and concussions has become a popular debate. And this has really brought into the question the safety of contact sports and their potential long-term consequences or negative consequences, particularly associated with those sports and sport leagues where repetitive hits to the head are common. For example, the NCAA, the NHL, and the NFL. The other interesting thing about causation is, to date, any consensus groups being a collection of individuals discussing a particular subject and considered to be experts in the field, get together and make consensus statements. So to date, consensus groups have not yet linked contact sports to CTE via the available evidence that is present. While there is some speculation, speculation does not lead to causation through the current criteria. One of the primary reasons that this exists is the lack of longitudinal studies. Because, again, CTE is such a new subject, we don't have longer-term studies following people throughout their lives that may participate in contact sports and then seeing how they're doing later down the line. What is causation? Causation is, does A cause B? Does a particular, in this case, environmental exposure, repeated hits to the head, cause cumulative traumatic encephalopathy? The important thing to understand, and I think this is really, really important, and I've posted this on my social media since I read this quote, is outside of communicable or Mendelian genetic diseases. So what that means is essentially outside of genetic links to disease, causation is rarely proven or established, especially for diseases involving complex environmental exposures. In these instances, causation is a continuum from highly unlikely to highly likely, and no single study can prove causation. So instead of saying, does A cause B, what we're really trying to discuss is, what is the likelihood that A causes B? For example, we know that smoking cigarettes doesn't always cause lung cancer, but what is the inherent risk there, or what is the likelihood that smoking cigarettes would cause lung cancer? So Bradford Hill uses 9 pieces of criteria to try and establish causation. And again, this isn't just for CTE. This is particularly any circumstance where someone is exposed to an environmental agent, and then what is the likelihood that that would develop into a disease later on in life. And the first criteria is known as strength of association. And this is the use of statistics to look at how strongly something may be associated. And often the outcome of that is cited as a relative risk, which means with exposure, will a disease be contracted? And when we look at relative risk, it's something known as an odds ratio. And an odds ratio that's greater than one means it's very unlikely that the thing in question is caused by a random chance. So there's a stronger association with it being linked to the cause of the disease. Now, in this study, Nowinski looked at six very large brain bank studies, and the results of those six studies looked at odds ratios which ranged from anywhere from the low end of 1.73, which is still above one, all the way to 902. Now, the majority, all of these studies were, again, post-mortem or autopsy of brains that were donated through brain banks. What does that mean in terms of strength of association? 1.73 all the way to 902. We know that odds ratios of greater than one means that it's probably not random that these things are linked together. For a little bit of context, often one study with an odds ratio above two is an ample enough evidence for a regulatory body or agency to conclude that a particular agent is deemed as harmful. So here we have six studies that are above an odds ratio of one. Five of the six were well above an odds ratio of one. And so via this criteria of strength of association, there is adequate means to say that A would cause B. The second criterion in Bradford Hill is consistency. So most of the cases of CTE have been reported through Boston University's CTE Center, as most of the brains end up in autopsy there. And most of these brains are donated by the University of Buffalo Veteran Hospital Brain Bank. Now, in saying this, consistency is looking at variations within the population and seeing if something is consistent across the variations of the population. So while the majority of cases have been looked at in the University of Boston, there have also been findings across multiple demographics in multiple countries. And in the majority of these countries, there is still a consistent association between repetitive head impact and CTE. So there is a little bit of, well, not a little bit, there is consistency in the finding that it's not like CTE is a disease only in the United States. It's across multiple countries in multiple demographics with the seemingly strong association with a history of repetitive head impact. After consistency, the question of specificity is often asked. And specificity is whether there is a link between a disease and a specific population or a specific part of the anatomy when there is no other reasonable explanation for the involvement of that disease other than the factor in question, in this case, repetitive hits or repetitive head impacts. So in terms of CTE and head impacts, specificity can be observed in a number of ways. Most significantly, by the fact that prior exposure to repetitive head impacts is the only known unifying factor among CTE cases that are reported in the literature to date. And therefore, repetitive head impacts seem to be the only common denominator across all populations that suffer from this disease outside of all the other things that are investigated. So there does seem to be some specificity that exists within the CTE population, which is repetitive head impacts. The question then when we talk about specificity is, well, could they just be getting a different disease and it's being sort of misdiagnosed or mischaracterized as CTE? So there have been some studies looking at this. There was a large postmortem study looking at 310 older individuals, looking at something known as age-related tau astrogliopathy or astrogliopathy. And this is a disease that's commonly found in the general aging population. So it's commonly referred to as age-related brain changes or brain changes related to aging. And depending upon the studies that you look at, it's anywhere from 35 to 40% of the population. And when those individuals were looked at, there was no evidence of CTE neural pathology within the individuals. And there was also no common trends of association with long-term playing of sports where repetitive head impacts were common. So this just strengthens the argument for specificity, where the only common denominator between CTE and the development of it seems to be repetitive head impacts. The next criteria is something known as temporality, and that is the timing between a factor and an outcome to assign a causal relationship. So when A happens and then B happens, how closely related are they? And this is often challenging for CTE because, as mentioned, it's only currently diagnosed postmortem after the person passes away. Given the wide age of the individuals that can suffer from CTE, it is likely that the actual pathology of it, the disease development of it, begins significantly before signs and symptoms are observed, and then further to that, the actual finding of it on postmortem exam. What that would suggest is it's not like CTE happens one day and the person dies that day or dies the next day. It is a progressive degenerative disease, as the name suggests. So that brings about the argument that, well, couldn't this pathology happen prior to exposure to repetitive hits to the head? So for example, could a subset of the population be getting this disease and then just happen to enter into sports like rugby, boxing, mixed martial arts, hockey, and then pass away from it or suffer consequences of it, and then this show up on their autopsy? This is pretty unlikely for a few reasons. First, as previously outlined, there is an absence of CTE pathology on people that haven't really been exposed to repetitive hits to the head. And if this argument was true, if the disease preceded the exposure to repetitive hits to the head, we'd see this disease more in the general population that didn't partake in sports. Secondly, although neurologic and neurodegenerative diseases are known to alter behavior, so for example, in some cases, they'll promote riskier behaviors, as well as some other neurodegenerative conditions like instability, slip and falls, alterations in gait, there is no evidence to support a neurologic phenotype for individuals who participate in contact or collision sports. So what this is suggesting is, again, there's not a neurological disease that causes people to then go more into contact sport. And then thirdly, the pathologies associated with CTE appears more severe as a function of time since the injury, as do any biomarkers that are associated with this pathology supporting the progressive pathological nature of the disease that's thought to be initiated by repetitive head trauma. In short, the more time that goes on, the more severe this disease seems to get. And therefore, it doesn't necessarily support the argument that someone would have had this disease and then somehow all of these people with it decide to then participate in sports that are of contact nature and then go on to suffer from these myriad of symptoms. This would be very, very highly unlikely of a scenario. The next criteria is that of a biological gradient. And particularly when we talk about biological gradients, we're talking about something called dose response. And dose responses, we look at with medication, we look at it with disease, and it's, you know, what is a therapeutic dose? What is a therapeutic dose of medication, for example? But the alternate to that when looking at disease is, well, what is the dose response? What specific dosage does it take to get a disease? And this can be incredibly challenging, and often this is one of the most challenging things in medicine. because really and truly, for something like CTE that appears in this population, we don't really know. And even when you look at cigarette smoke and its causation of cancer, we still don't really know adequate dose response either. We don't know, you know, how many cigarettes a day you have to smoke to get cancer. We don't know what the particular agent within a cigarette is that causes cancer, whether it's one specific or numerous. We don't know the ratio of firsthand smoke to secondhand smoke, for example. So dose response is a really, really difficult question to answer. But there was a researcher with his research group, Metz et al., that looked at years of football played and a dose response relationship between CTE. And he found that there was a strong dose response relationship between the onset of CTE and the years of football played. The Boston University research group also came up with statistics that for each additional year of football played, you had an increased odds ratio of 1.3, which doubled your chances of getting the disease for every about 2.6 years of football played. They also looked at the development of severe CTE versus mild symptoms, and each additional year of play had an odds ratio of 1.14, which meant that you had an increased chance of getting severe symptoms for every additional 5.3 years of football played. Now, we know that there's, again, bias in this research because the research is from brain banks. Much of the time, these brain banks are subject to selection bias because you're getting them from veterans' brain banks or you're getting them from individuals that have played sports and donated their brain to science. There's also been a researcher named LeClaire who looked at a study with 290 participants looking at the odds ratio of playing 1 year of high school football versus college football versus pro football. And what they found was that players at the college level had a 1.82 higher risk or chance risk of diagnosis than players that played high school. And further to that, players that went on to play pro had a 2.13 times higher risk than players that played high school. Further citing this, the strength of association, but also citing that time frame in participation within a particular sport, the longer you played a sport, the seemingly increased chance of developing CTE later in life that you had. So that was really, really interesting in trying to, again, look at dose response. Can we see or relate a particular time frame for the playing of sports to a risk ratio for developing a disease? Because it should be noted that there will be people, plenty of people, that play contact sports that do not develop CTE, as well as there will be people that smoke cigarettes that don't develop cancer. So a lot of the things that we do, and I talked about this on the last episode that I did with respect to alcohol consumption, a lot of this is about relative risk and people doing their own individual risk assessments based on their lifestyle and the environmental factors that they will interact with. The next criteria that Nowinski looked at in his study is known as plausibility. So can the association between repetitive head impacts and CTE be explained in the presence of existing biological or social models? The biggest question here is the latency between the repetitive head impacts and CTE. Because they're so often far apart, that would be an argument to say, well, look, these aren't really associated because they happen in such a large time frame in many instances. There are some animal studies, and while animal studies cannot be kind of extrapolated to human studies, there are some animal studies that have been able to, while they haven't been able to immediately produce CTE, because we know that's not really the way the disease develops, they have been able to notice that when a concussion is induced, the protein that's often found in CTE, phosphorylated tau protein, is present in the brain immediately following a concussion. And they have been able to show in animal studies that this has been followed by later production of pathological p-tau deposits within the brain. Is there plausible biological mechanism? In human studies, not really, but there are animal studies that show plausibility within animals. Next is coherence. And coherence means that the data that we have on a particular disease does not seriously conflict with what is already known about the disease or exposure. So for example, exposure to repetitive head impacts does not conflict with what we know about the development of CTE. One of the things that helps strengthen this argument is the extreme differences between CTE in men versus women. The University of Boston has now diagnosed hundreds, if not thousands, of men with CTE, and they have yet to diagnose a female. And I'm not even sure if a female has yet to be diagnosed worldwide postmortem. So this sex differential reflects differences predominantly in sport participation. Therefore, more men have exposure to repetitive head impacts than women. The primary findings of this research, the majority of this research occurs in American football, and we know that sport participation, particularly beyond high school level in football, so college football and professional football, would be 99%+ men that participate in that. The alternate hypothesis that's often cited in the research for CTE is it could be related to other things. So for example, it could be related to substance abuse, it could be related to another mental health disorder that we just don't necessarily understand and we aren't seeing it, genetics, lifestyle factors, etc. The only thing that has really been shown to create a similar disease process in the brain, somewhat similar, is opiate use. And this, so heroin use, for example, causes or is correlated with the hyperphosphorylation of tau. Now, that alternate hypothesis has some problems with it, mainly because on an autopsy, the use of opiate medication or the chronic use of opiate medication or drugs is easily distinguishable from CTE. So while there's hyperphosphorylation of tau in opiate use, it's distributed differently in the brain than in CTE. And the second trouble with that argument is the majority of people in the research thus far have no history of opiate abuse that has been seen in all of the research that's present. The second to last criteria within the Bradford Hill criteria is experimental or experiment. What that means is, can we appeal to any experimental evidence to prove the current causation? So for example, do we have any data on preventative measures or efforts that can take place to reduce CTE? The problem with that is, firstly, CTE has been recognized in the last really 20 years, and therefore, in terms of prevention, I'd mentioned that we don't have a lot of longitudinal studies, so there aren't a lot of those studies that exist looking across a lifetime of what preventative measures might in fact reduce the onset of CTE. As earlier mentioned, they have been animal or rat studies that have looked at repetitive head impacts and the development of phosphorylated tau that has been able to be deposited into the brain immediately and then further to that develop a little bit later on after the initial hit to the head or hits to the head. One of the common critiques in looking at experimental data is a lot of research on concussion is often criticized because of the way that the studies are structured, either being done retrospectively, so looking back, or observationally, as a lot of these type of studies are subjective in nature. They don't have a lot of statistics or data, objective data, that are often related to what the individuals are going through. The challenge with this is you can argue that things that the individuals are going through could be confounding the results. So for example, lifestyle factors. So if you have a concussion, for example, and you're experiencing anxiety post-concussion. Well, are you experiencing anxiety from the concussion, or are you experiencing anxiety because you have prior struggles with anxiety? That's a very difficult thing to prove causation with. With respect to experimental data, while we have it in animal models, we don't have it in human models because of the challenges with, first of all, devising those experiments, and secondly, the kaleidoscope or myriad of symptoms that people suffer from, not only with respect to concussion, but CTE and brain injury in general. No brain injury is going to present similarly between two people. The last factor to being analyzed with respect to criteria for causation is analogy. And what analogy means is, can prior knowledge and patterns of something infer or predict a similar causal association? We know that in 2020, there was a Lancet study on dementia prevention that cited a reduction in dementia, the onset of dementia, with the lack of a midlife traumatic brain injury as a key strategy for preventing dementia later on in life. So there's evidence for supporting TBI as a causal risk for dementia, similar to the associated risk between repetitive head injury and CTE. Again, one of the biggest analogies that's discussed in this paper is smoking and cancer. Smoking and cancer satisfied all Bradford Hill criteria. It was very, very controversial at the time, citing the risk between smoking and cancer, particularly even secondhand smoke and cancer, for a variety of reasons. The tobacco companies, massive industries at the time, were pushing back and lobbying to not have this discussion be present. But even still today, where we know that cigarette smoke causes cancer, we can't answer some of those questions that I discussed before. What constitutes smoking a cigarette? Why do people get cancer and other people do not? What particular carcinogen within a cigarette causes cancer, or is it a subset of multiple? How many cigarettes is too many cigarettes per day? Are there any other confounding variables or factors that are involved in smoking that would prevent or lead to more cancer, smoking indoors versus in outdoor settings? These are questions that we don't have answers to and probably never will, but that does not mean that we deny the fact that smoking cigarettes causes cancer. And so this is a similar discussion around CTE. Are there other causal relationships related to brain injury and the development of similar presentations? There are in the research. And so this is how Nowinski used the Bradford Hill criteria to come up with the conclusion that repetitive head impacts is a causative factor for the disease cumulative traumatic encephalopathy. So before, in episode 72, I'd said that there was no evidence because there wasn't. Now there is evidence. There's this one systematic review paper that looks at six large studies looking at the association between repetitive head impacts and the development of CTE. So what now? Why does this matter? It's very interesting to see how certain individuals have responded to this paper, because it is quite new. For example, quite a well-known hockey player in Canada, Jonathan Huberdeau, has come out and said that he will donate his brain to Endless Canada, which looks at, it's essentially a brain bank looking at these type of diseases. Jonathan Huberdeau's agent, Alan Walsh, has been a really vocal individual on player safety. He's been a really harsh critic of how the NHL, particularly in this case, has handled recent head trauma research. It's quite interesting that the Toronto Star here in Canada put out an article on this study, and almost immediately the deputy commissioner of the NHL, Bill Daly, came out and made a media statement saying, and I quote, "A single medical article does not determine our views on the issue. We rely on consensus statements to further how we direct our player safety." It's interesting because in the last consensus statement for concussion, because of the lack of evidence, there was no statement that repetitive head impacts had a causative factor in CTE. And so a lot of prominent organizations were able to leverage this and say, A does not cause B. Playing football, boxing, MMA, hockey, there is no evidence or research to suggest that those two are related. And again, while there was speculation, there wasn't really a paper like this that has come out and made this statement. Now, there also hasn't been a consensus statement in concussion since 2017 for a number of reasons. So pandemic had a part to play in that. So it's going to be interesting now when the next consensus statement that's made on concussion comes about, because that will be a collective group of people from around the world that have a specialty in concussion, and the fallout and impact of concussion from a global perspective and a long-term perspective. And if they come to the conclusion that there is now some evidence that links the participation in sports where repetitive head impacts are present and the potential onset of negative consequences of that later in life, it will be interesting to see now if sporting organizations change how they operate even more to address player safety. And we've seen this, even though there isn't this evidence that's present, we've seen a trickle-down effect of the speculation in youth athletics. A lot of sports have taken, for example, in soccer, heading out of practice. They've taken contact out of football practice, and they've made football practices non-contact. There have been strides to reduce overall impacts to the head in circumstances where coaches and players and administrators don't feel that they're maybe necessary. We know in striking sports like boxing and MMA, true full-on sparring or fighting is used a lot less than it used to be in the past. So people, regardless of what the evidence say, seem to be trending in this direction. But it can be problematic when individuals in high positions within organizations come out and deny these claims because they're choosing to cite an article or cite a consensus statement that now might be 5 years old versus something that's more recently published. The other thing about making a statement that it's one paper, again, systematic reviews often look at a collection of broad scale evidence. So even though it's one paper, it's looking at a collective body of research. So to make the claim one paper, again, might also not be quite accurate. So this was really interesting. I'm going to link the paper as well as my previous episode on CTE so you can learn a little bit more about what that is if you're sort of unfamiliar with it in the show notes. My question for you is, what do you think about this study? Does it change the way you communicate with anyone if you're a clinician with respect to contact sports? If you're a parent or you participate in contact sports yourself, does it change the way you view contact sports at all? I'd love to know in the comments below. As always, folks, I hope that you found this episode to be of value to you. Have yourselves a great day, and we'll see you in the next one.